What's OPEC going to do?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. The price of oil hasn't been this low since early spring. Oil hit $104 a barrel this morning. That's a 30% drop from the record high of July 11th. It looks like Hurricane Ike won't be a major threat to the Gulf. But the oil cartel OPEC is meeting right now to decide whether it will reduce its output and drive the price back up. Iran and a couple of other countries want to do that. Saudi Arabia is standing firm and says the oil market is in good balance right now. Gas prices have crushed our wallets all summer, and that's why the bus and the subway are much more crowded. We got the latest numbers this morning from a public transit industry group known as the APTA. More from Marketplace's Janet Babin at North Carolina Public Radio.
Public transit ridership is up more than 5% this year. All this train and bus hopping is directly related to high gas prices. APTA President William Millar says public transit systems have reached a tipping point. They can't accommodate new riders without a cash infusion. But the housing crisis and credit crunch have state and local budgets tapped out. Millar says it's time the federal government helped pay the bill,
so that public transit systems can add service to serve additional customers who are looking to beat that high cost of gasoline.
Millar says when people use public transit, our air is cleaner and there's less congestion. He'll make the case to a Senate committee today that these benefits deserve federal dollars. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Wall Street had a fat rally yesterday on the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but it might have been a one-day bounce. So far, just minor gains for the Dow, 26 points, a fraction to 11,536. The NASDAQ is up 11 points. The S&P 500 is down 3, though. In Asia, the markets were back down again today, close to 2% losses. European shares are mixed so far. Today, for the first time in decades, the Colonel Sanders chicken recipe will be moved from the KFC headquarters in Louisville, Kentucky. This is the handwritten recipe of 11 herbs and spices signed by the Colonel himself. We don't know where it's going or why it's being moved, but no one will get their hands on it. KFC has hired a security team to transport this yellowing piece of notebook paper. The recipe will be locked in a briefcase that's handcuffed to a security guard. This is the Morning Report for Tuesday, September 9th on Marketplace.org. The thing about government bailouts is this. Once you start, everybody wants one. First, there was Bear Stearns. Now there's Fannie and Freddie. And today in Washington, the car industry is looking for some love. I mean, money from Congress. Here's John Dimsdale.
Car makers need new capital to retool for more fuel-efficient vehicles, but lenders are demanding premium interest rates since prospects for car company profits are dim. So the industry wants government-subsidized loans at low interest rates. Why should taxpayers help? David Cole at the Center for Automotive Research says because the government is requiring more fuel-efficient cars.
In a sense, the government has laid some pretty heavy stuff on the industry, and one of the consequences of the run-up in energy prices is a dramatic reduction in revenue by the industry.
After Fannie and Freddie, Congress may not have a taste for more government bailouts, but Cole says in the end, there may not be a cost to taxpayers.
The Chrysler bailout in the early 1980s, the government actually made money.
Car makers are also making a political appeal. What politician wants to see more layoffs from car factories in the swing states of Michigan and Ohio? In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Apple loves to sucker the media into hyping its new products. I guess we got suckered. Apple is unveiling something today in San Francisco that's got the blogosphere buzzing. Rachel Dornhelm has more.
Apple enthusiasts are hoping for a little silicon sizzle today. Tom Krazit covers Apple for CNET. He says expect new iPods across the board.
A redesigned iPod Nano as probably the centerpiece of that announcement, a lower-priced iPod Touch and possibly higher-capacity iPod Shuffles.
Online chatter centers on a large touchscreen device or a monthly subscription service on iTunes. Investors want a good look at the company's reclusive CEO, Steve Jobs. Analyst Roger Kay of Endpoint Technologies Associates says there's been a lot of talk about Jobs' illness.
Wall Street would look at Steve's health and say, well, the thing that matters to us most is the guy good to go for leading the company for the next year or two?
And there is another audience Apple has to address today. Buyers, those of us looking for fixes to recent product bugs. In San Francisco, I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
Newspaper ad revenue is falling off a cliff. No real news there, but here's something I didn't know. College newspapers are getting squeezed. Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
The University of California Berkeley's Daily Californian is having some trouble living up to its name. The student-run paper lost half of its national advertising this year and has stopped printing on Wednesdays to save money. It's also slashed its staff by 25%. Editor-in-chief Brian Thomas says the paper has to retool its business model.
While we would love to just stay in the old model of print advertising, it's just not going to happen that way.
Thomas says the paper is expanding its online edition and trying to attract internet ads. Tom Rosensteel directs the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He says college papers have traditionally been protected from industry ups and downs.
The people who want to reach those students know that this is the best way to do it. But the same economic forces do affect small advertisers who are the backbone of college newspapers.
And because most college newspapers are free, ads represent just about all of their revenue. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Today is day four of the Boeing strike. Machinists and aerospace workers have walked off the job, and they might be gone for a while. Measuring what those people do is fairly easy compared to, say, measuring the output of your typical office worker. And that's a problem, says commentator Stephen Baker.
It was more than a century ago that an engineer named Frederick Taylor walked into factories and started timing workers with a stopwatch. He dissected their movements and organized them more efficiently. He turned factory production into a science. Information workers have labored largely outside the range of such measurement. After all, it's easier for bosses to count the revolutions of a crankshaft than the generation of ideas. But now office workers are marching straight toward the assembly line. The monitoring tool, the 21st century equivalent of Taylor's stopwatch, is the computer. Those of us who use them produce rivers of data describing the hours of our workday. Cell phones and BlackBerries add even more details. Now scientists are starting to track our behavior, much like Taylor, and figure out how to squeeze more production out of us. This is happening at IBM Research. Dozens of mathematicians and computer scientists, I call them the numerati, are poring over the data of 50,000 of their colleagues. They're looking at their contacts, calendars, the patterns of the emails they write, the information they post on social networks. Their goal is to build mathematical models of the workers and then manage them with algorithms. The way IBM describes it, managing will be a little like booking a vacation online. Let's say the manager needs to send a 5-person team to Beijing. She types in the particulars, and the system searches for just the right workers. They should be compatible, live near airports, have the right language and technical skills, and come in under budget. Maybe they've all thrived in Asia or in smoky locales. By representing workers as math, IBM hopes to find the right person for the right job at the right price at exactly the right time. And that's how, by delivering the details of our work and our lives to the numerati, we assume our position in the new global assembly lines of information workers. It's enough to make you want to grab a dumb old pencil and sharpen it.
Stephen Baker is the author of The Numerati. He's a senior writer for Business Week magazine. We'll be right back. In certain movie theaters in Britain today, there's no popcorn. The Picture House theater chain has banned popcorn on Tuesdays. The company says some people just hate it. The taste, the smell, the noise, and of course, the price. A big tub of popcorn costs about 60 cents, but at the movies you pay $7 or $8. There's actually a new book about this and other pricing puzzles. Richard McKenzie wrote, Why Popcorn Costs So Much at the Movies. Richard, why does it?
One of the reasons that popcorn is so expensive is that theaters see themselves in the concession business. James Edwards, founder of the Edwards Theater Chain, once said, I show you movies in order to sell you popcorn. And over half of the gate receipts at movie theaters can go to the studios.
Right.
So what you want to do is keep the price of the tickets down in order that you can raise the price of popcorn.
And people are willing to pay the price because it's convenient.
It's convenient. It's also what the theater industry calls smellable, audible, edible.
It suckers me in every single time without fail. Even if I say I don't really want popcorn, you get there and the smell, it's over.
And once they get you hooked, I mean, there are all kinds of chemicals being released in the brain and so forth that makes moviegoers price insensitive.
Now let's talk about the different sizes and explain to us what the best value is for your money with popcorn.
Okay, well, what the theaters are doing is walking you up your demand curve and charging you a high price for the first few ounces. Then they're sort of walking you down. They know they can sell you more, but they've got to drastically lower the price on those marginal ounces.
Show us what you're talking about.
Okay, what I'm going to do is pour out the contents of a full tub of popcorn, the large.
All right, there we go.
And then I'm going to take the medium bag. And I'm going to pour it into the tub. And as you can see,
it overflows.
It's on the floor.
So why do people buy the large?
Well, I think some of them think that they're getting more popcorn. But you also get the option of free refills. And there are some customers who will buy the tub and then on the way out of the theater ask for another
no
refill
kidding.
To take at home. And once you get two refills, you've got the price of popcorn at the margin down to less than 8 cents an ounce.
That's a heck of a lot of popcorn, though.
I have to warn you that if you get a tub, refill it twice, and smother all three tubs with butter, you're going to be consuming the calories recommended for an adult male for 3 days.
Jeez, sounds awful. And is this psychological pricing, or is there an economic reason behind it?
Fundamental law in economics is the law of demand. That is, what they're doing is simply charging you more on those very first few ounces, and you're willing to pay more for the first few ounces by the law of demand.
Mm-hmm.
But to get you to buy more, they got to lower the price drastically.
Richard McKenzie, his book is called Why Popcorn Costs So Much at the Movies. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Finally this morning, the latest edition of the Farmer's Almanac is out. It predicts a colder than normal winter, and it has some advice on how to beat home heating costs. One tip from the 1770s suggests you can stay warm all winter with only one log. You just take it upstairs, throw it out the window, run down and get it, and do it all over again. That'll certainly keep the blood flowing. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.